تمتطيه قوس قزح طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلاد.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we deal with the contrasting Palestinian and Zionist narratives that drive the debate on the Israel-Palestine struggle. Each week we begin this program with an introduction that claims that the purpose of This Week in Palestine is to present the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is so often missing in the Israel-Palestine discussion and analysis in the American media and within the American Academy. The two narratives often clash in various forums where the differing narratives are presented and debated. This week we present illustrative portions of two such forums. In the first forum, the Palestinian narrative is presented by Ilan Pappe, and the second by Norman Finkelstein. Israeli historian Ilan Pappe is one of the greatest assets that we, who try to project the Palestinian narrative, have. That is because he is an impeccable historian. His book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, meticulously documents the expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of over 350 Palestinian villages as Israel took their land and declared the State of Israel. Other historians have documented the ethnic cleansing as well. And while historical interpretations may vary, the facts of the ethnic cleansing have been well established, documented from the archives of the Israeli military. What sets Pappe apart is his willingness to challenge the Zionist false narrative in forums throughout the world, to expose himself to the slings and arrows of those who denigrate his work and try to discredit the Palestinian narrative, which, as we will see, is standing up well to international scrutiny and increasingly being accepted by the international community. The first feature presentation on This Week in Palestine is a recording of a portion of a forum presented on a television program called Q&A, broadcast in Australia, where the Zionist narrative was defended against Pape's historical fact-based analysis. You, the listener, are once again at a bit of a disadvantage trying to follow the conversation when you cannot see the participants. But I think that it becomes quite clear which narratives are being defended at any given moment. Ilan Pappe is the major presenter of the Palestinian narrative, and an attorney by the name of Irving Wallach is the major defender of the Zionist narrative. There are three other participants, Greg Sheridan, Glover Moore, and Robin Davidson, who chip in comments along the way. The portion of this forum you will hear is from the question and answer period and begins with a question from a young Palestinian woman.
Our next question comes from Janine Abdul-Khalik. My question is for Ilan Pape. I am of Palestinian descent. My parents were refugees, my grandparents refugees, and my great-grandparents refugees. The state of Israel was established on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the displacement of three-quarters of the Palestinian population. Palestinians have since been subjected to apartheid and a military occupation and the continued confiscation of their land and resources. How can we confront the popular pro-Israel narrative that Israel's a democracy?
Ilan Pape, you seem to have devoted much of your life to confronting this narrative.
Thank you for this very important question. And indeed, that's a very good question. How can one oppose a narrative that is so hegemonic, that is accepted by such a powerful coalition? So many people in the West accept it. So many people among the Jewish and the Christian communities accept it. And of course, most of the Israeli Jews accept it. And that's a powerful coalition. And I think that the way to challenge a narrative which is false, which in fact serves as a basis for the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestine. As you are aware, the ethnic cleansing has not stopped in 1948. It still continues as we speak today. The best way is, first of all, to inform people about the truth, about what happened. And I think many more academics than ever before in the Western world are now telling the truth about what happened in Palestine. What once used to be the narrative just a few Palestinians is quite frankly the accepted narrative in most academic institutions in the world. Mainstream media in the West finds it very difficult to accept the narrative, although they know that this is the true narrative.
Can I just pause your narrative just there for a moment? Your early work as an historian, in a way, is what got you into trouble with the Jewish authorities, the academic authorities and other authorities. It was about uncovering what you believe were documents about what actually happened in 1948 and what you've described as the village files. I think in order to understand the argument better, you should tell us what the village files are exactly. Indeed. And how they pertain to this argument.
Yes, definitely. The Jewish establishment before the creation of the State of Israel has prepared a file on every Palestinian village and neighborhood in Palestine, so as to prepare the Jewish forces when the opportunity would come for taking over these villages. And the files had a map, an aerial photography, and a very detailed explanation of what to expect once the village would become Jewish property, in terms of wealth, in terms of number of people, and what to accept in terms of resistance. I think what it showed to me as an historian, and that refers to the question, that part of the missing narrative, if you want, was the systematic preparation of the Zionist movement for the expulsion of the Palestinians in 1948.
You describe this, and this where this comes from our questioner, you describe it as a plan for ethnic cleansing, but is there actual evidence for this, and what do other historians in Israel say when confronted with the documents that you say proves this?
Right. Well, I think there are 5.5 million Palestinian refugees who are the evidence that the ethnic cleansing took place. You don't need documents for that.
Well, I mean, we can go through the detail of that in a moment, but there was obviously a war.
And every Palestinian, every Jewish settlement in Israel is built on the ruins of a Palestinian settlement.
Tony, can I just interrupt you?
Evidence.
Yes. I think we need to refer to some facts rather than polemic. And the point is that everyone misses is that the real tragedy of 1947 and 1948 was that there was no Palestinian state established. That's the tragedy, and once you realise that's the starting point, then the refugee problem of what happened flows from there. The United Nations proposed a partition plan, which there'd be a Palestinian state established alongside a Jewish state. Now the problem is, and the problem was, that literally from the day after, and I say this not with any degree of joy, but it's a note of the tragedy. From the day after, the Palestinian people announced forcefully and without reservation that they rejected the plan. They rejected the concept of having a Jewish state next to a Palestinian state. Had they accepted the plan, had they accepted the two-state solution then the opportunity for the war and for what happened afterwards would never have arisen. And what happened was that on December the 2nd, 1947, there was a general strike proclaimed in Jerusalem. There were riots, Jewish shops, people were attacked. The Palestinian leader at the time, the Haj Amin al-Husseini, was a man who had spent the war years, and don't forget this is 1947, this is 2.5 years after the end of World War II. The Palestinian leader, Haj Amin al-Husseini, was a man who had spent the war years in Berlin being photographed shaking hands with Hitler.
Now, I think this is exactly the narrative that we want to interrupt and disrupt. And even if it's presented by an articulate barrister, it doesn't make it truth. These are sheer lies.
Excuse me, Ilan.
You are lying. It's a pity.
Excuse me. I think we need to keep the language to firstly respectable level, and secondly to an objective level. Any person here can go to the internet the minute you leave the studio, Google Haj Amin al-Husseini, and what comes up on Wikipedia, on any other number of sites, are photographs of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, shaking hands with Hitler, overseeing and congratulating the raising of German army units amongst Muslims, and secondly, a Waffen-SS unit named after the Palestinians and after Muslims. Now, I don't say that anything flows from that other than this shows who the Palestinians' leadership were. And these were the people who started a war in 1947.
Okay, all right, let's settle this issue of the Mufti of Jerusalem, because I've seen those pictures. Seen the history. He was connected to Hitler. There isn't any doubt about that, is there?
Stupid behavior by a Palestinian leader does not justify the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. A Palestinian refusal to accept the partition plan may be justified, maybe not be justified. What is not justified is punishing the Palestinians by depopulating half of the people. We have to understand what happened in 1948. Imagine half of the population of a country was forcefully expelled. Half of the villages of the country were destroyed. Half of the towns were demolished. Now, is this the right punishment for the wrong vote in the United Nations? Is this the right punishment for a leader who made a stupid mistake during the Second World War? This is not a tragedy. 1948 is a crime against humanity.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. We've got a couple of other questioners. We're going to go to Marianne Fraser.
After all the pogroms throughout the centuries, with Jews never being able to own land in any country they lived in, and being forced from their homes time and time again, as portrayed so well in my favourite musical, Fiddler on the Roof, and after the horrors of the Holocaust, isn't it just for Jews to have been given a place to call their own?
Ilan.
You know, it always reminds me about people who would look for a safe place for battered women or abused children. And in order to find the safe place, they would go to a home where another family lives, throw them out of the balcony in order to make a safe haven for the escaped people. Of course, the Jews were entitled to have a safe place. And in many ways, the Palestinians were willing to give them a safe place. What they were not willing to give them is the right to take over their homeland. I think there's a difference between giving a refuge, which for some reason you Australians refuse to give to these poor boat people, and a group of people who come. Imagine if these boat people today would have knocked on the door of Australia and said, "My dear people of Australia, 2,000 years ago it used to be my homeland. You have to give me half of it now and a third of it later on." This will never be accepted by anyone in Australia, and rightly so.
One of our questioners, someone's got a hand up there. I'll just go to the young woman with a hand up. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
referring to before you were speaking about the Palestinian leader.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, behind me?
It was actually behind you.
Oh, yeah. Sarah, sorry.
Sorry, yeah. There you go.
In light of what the lady ahead said, why is it that other people and nations like the Kurds, Assyrians and Gypsies were not given their right place of a homeland? And why was there a special privilege to the people of the Jewish land? We have a greater problem here that needs to be addressed, that is well-founded and rooted in the establishment of borders in 1920. And this is a problem that is larger than what it looks like.
Okay, let's go to Greg Sheridan here. I've kept the other panel out of the debate because it's been focused on two people on the panel, but I want to hear from the rest of the panelists.
Haven't I been magnificently silent through all that debate? It's the longest debate on Israel ever held in Australia in which I haven't spoken, you know. You'll be astonished
and
to hear that I...
spend your first minute talking about that.
I comprehensively reject Ilan's narrative of Israel. I think it's wrong in every respect. I haven't had time to read all Ilan's books, but I read this week devastating critiques of them by historians who are very critical of Israel in all their factual inaccuracy. Benny Morris, many other historians who are very, very critical of Israel, not servants of the Israeli government. Now, the other thing I would reflect on, no other nation in the world constantly has its legitimacy questioned in the way Israel does. It's the object of Western policy to reassure North Korea that we accept its legitimacy. We accept the legitimacy of Iran. The Americans have gone out of their way to say we're not trying to destroy your nation or even change your regime. It's the most extreme regime in the world racing to a nuclear weapon. Saudi Arabia funds extremism all over the world. The gentleman earlier was talking about hostile international forces funding extremism. Israel is a struggling democracy which makes mistakes, including moral mistakes, and deserves to be called on them. But no country in the world is subject to this attack at the root of its legitimacy that it should not exist. I spend a lot of time in the Middle East, a lot of time in Muslim countries. There is no country in the Middle East which better observes human rights of all of its citizens than Israel.
Okay, I want to hear from the rest of our panels. Before we do that, we have a video from Lawrence Gluck in North Bondi, New South Wales.
I am a regular viewer of Q&A and find that many interesting topics are discussed. However, seldom is a Jewish perspective offered. How ironic is it, therefore, that when a topic of significant relevance to the Jewish community is presented, it coincides with one of the holiest days of the Jewish calendar, Rosh Hashanah. This therefore prevents observant Jews from being able to attend as members of your audience, or even to watch the broadcast, and to add to that useful barometer of public support or condemnation, namely the Twitter chatter. Thank you.
Okay, first of all, this is the only night that Ilan Pappe was available to come on Q&A. A lot of people have made this same point, but we thought it was an important debate and should go on anyway. Irving Wallach is here from the Jewish community. I'm interested to know, just get your reflections on what that gentleman just said, because we have got a lot of mail on this.
Yes. Look, I have to say that when I was invited to come on to Q&A, it was turned out to be this night, caused a minor sensation at home, and at which there were several glasses dropped along the lines of, you're what? You're going on television on the night of Rosh Hashanah. And I said, yes, I was. So it is a point, and it is a real shame that it has come up on this night, because a lot of people that I've talked to in synagogue today wanted to participate in things or possibly go to the audience and obviously to take part in the program. Look, can I say this about Ilan's whole point of view? And that is this. It is designed and intended to perpetuate a conflict model and a conflict narrative. Now, it's all right to go around flinging words such as ethnic cleansing when there are no documents that can be used and relied on to say there was ethnic cleansing. There was a war, and that happened and started in 1947. There have been attempts by both sides, and they've come close in 2000, 2001, and then 2008 to actually settle this on a real cooperative two-state basis. Now, if you want to go on and carry on in the fashion that Ilan does and throw about the clichés and the accusations, then a couple of things follow. Firstly, you have to seriously consider surrendering your claim to be an objective historian. Secondly, what has to be done is that you have to consider and accept that what you are wanting to do is to encourage ongoing conflict and battles and death and destruction between the Israeli people and the Palestinian people. If you want to go along the conflict road, then forget about peace. If you want to promote Israel as a so-called pariah state for your own political and ideological agenda, go ahead. History will not thank you for it.
Ilan, can I respond?
First of all, about the legitimacy of Israel. I think Israel is not seeking a legitimacy. Israel is seeking a legitimacy as being a racist state within the civilized community of states.
Please,
I didn't interrupt you. You taught me a lesson about being polite, so try to apply it to yourself. Now, Israel wants to remain a racist state and a democratic state. This is an oxymoron. I met some Australian oxymorons. I won't outstretch my hospitality. But this is an oxymoron. Secondly, the documentation for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, for Israeli criminal policies since 1948 are there. In fact, most Israeli historians recognize them. The debate in Israel is not factual. The debate in Israel is moral. Whether it was right to do so, as Benny Morris says, in self-defense, to ethnically cleanse another people, or it wasn't moral. I think it was immoral, not Jewish, and inhuman.
But what's being challenged here is the documentation, as in history.
Documentation is not challenged. Nobody challenges the documentation.
Tony, if I might say something, is the slur of an ethnic cleansing as opposed to war, followed by refugees. That's what's under challenge.
Yes. Now,
and in that regard, Ilan is on his own.
I'm totally alone in it with another 5 to 6 million Palestinians and another 10 billion people in the world. Now, the point that I'm making...
There are only 6 billion
six
people.
Million, well, that's right. I extended it to the universe, I'm sure. Right. I'm sure even aliens understand that the Zionist version is wrong. Now,
I'm going to get you to sum the point up because we haven't heard from at least two of our panelists.
Just the final point, which is very important. By the time the so-called war started, in the 15th of May 1948, when Arab armies entered Palestine, already half of the Palestinians became refugees. So Palestinians became refugees before the war, not because of the war. And in fact, this was the plan, and this is the kind of an unpleasant reality that Israelis would have to come to terms with so that Jews and Arabs could live in peace and reconciliation. Any other avenue would perpetuate the conflict forever.
Clover Moore, you've sat very patiently through this, and so has Robin. I want to hear from both of you now.
Well, I just think that history's fine, and I acknowledge that there have been terrible experiences of the Jewish people during particularly the Hitler era and for Palestinians as well. But, you know, I think we really should be talking about solutions here. I think of the families of the two communities and, you know, and then the bloodshed that continues to... The terrible trauma that those families of those communities experience, and I really think we should be all working very hard to try and find solutions.
Robin.
Well, yes, of course, try to find solutions. Not so easy.
Can I just add that Europeans came to this country 200 years ago. The Aboriginal community had been in this country for 60,000 years. Now, the Europeans dispossessed the Aboriginal people of their land, and we're now working very hard on reconciliation and making amends. And I really think reconciliation and coexistence and solutions for the Palestinian and Israeli communities is what should be the goal of everyone involved in this issue.
Very briefly, are you equating Aboriginal dispossession with Palestinian dispossession?
I think it's comparable, yes.
Robin.
Great. And I hope you will be re-elected despite all this. Okay.
It's obviously comparable, and I think Australians still don't, I mean, European Australians, the rest of us, in other words, still don't really understand what it means to have been dispossessed in that way. And our good life depends upon that dispossession, and therefore redress must be made. As regards Israel and Palestine, my God, you know, what a horrible debate it is, really. It strikes me there's been a lot of talk recently about Israel being like South Africa, and I think there is a case to be made there. But what it strikes me, the tragedy that it strikes me, is that neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians have thrown up a visionary leader like Mandela, who could provide a vision for that, for those two entities to come together in some way that isn't just the same old tribal nightmare.
Irving, well, do you accept that? I mean, could there emerge ever on either side of politics in the Middle East a leader that could actually overcome this dreadful rift, these divisions, with some form of compromise?
In the future, I believe we can, because the basis for compromise has already been laid. As I said, the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians have come very close on four, possibly five occasions. But can I say this about this question of Aboriginal people? My first job as a solicitor was with the South Coast Aboriginal Legal Service a while ago now. One of the things that surprised me was the number of my clients, Koori's, Aboriginal people, who came up to me at different times when I was working there and said, "Mate, we appreciate what you're doing. We feel just like you and your people, the Jews. We went through exactly what you're going through." Now, in terms of relations between Jews and Palestinians, all I can tell you from the Aboriginal side of things are the number of times Aboriginal people came up to me and said how they identified with Jewish people.
Tony, could I add one footnote about this question of refugees? The only reason we get these extraordinary numbers for Palestinian refugees is because every descendant unto the ages of the Palestinians is classed as a refugee, unlike every other refugee case in history or in contemporary life. So if you're a Palestinian, you go to live in Jordan, your son is born there, and then he has a son there, and the son becomes a successful businessman, is a Jordanian citizen, and enters the Jordanian cabinet, he is still a refugee. That doesn't apply anywhere else.
There are
800,000
Jews. Can we just get on the table how many
forced?
Can we just get on the table then how many refugees
no,
there
no,
were?
Just let
at
me
the
finish
beginning.
This point. There were 800,000 Jews who were forced in violent fashion out of Arab lands at about that same time. Now, you could claim, therefore, that there are 5 million Jewish refugees from Arab countries. Nobody does that because there's no political interest in maintaining this fiction of refugees.
Can I just refer to the point that every person who's born a Jew has a right to go and live in Israel? So that rather suggests that
there's not an equivalent. If you were forced out of Morocco because you were Jewish, your grandson, who is a cabinet minister in Israel, does not qualify as a refugee. But in the Palestinian case, your grandson, who is a cabinet minister in Jordan, is still classified actively by the United Nations as a refugee.
OK, let's hear from you. He makes a valid point about the numbers. So how many were there originally?
Well, first of all, we can trust or mistrust the United Nations, but the United Nations is the one that gives us the number of 5.5. So I trust the United Nations on this. Secondly, it's very important to understand that Palestinians would be the first one to support the right of Jews who left or were kicked out of Arab countries to return. I don't know of any Jew that supports the right of the Palestinians to return.
Right, I'm going to interrupt your flow. There was a gentleman with his hand up there for quite a while. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. We keep speaking about the history in 1948 and that. I was privileged enough to work in Israel and Palestine for the last 18 months and was even able to go into a meeting with the current mayor of Jerusalem. And at the time, he just announced 5,000 more Jewish settlements in homes in East Jerusalem. And when we questioned him about that, he actually laughed and said, "I've only announced 5,000, but there's actually 90,000 planned." So it's still going, and it is ethnic cleansing, as far as I'm concerned, from my first-hand experience.
Mm-hmm.
To come back to your question, and that is, how many refugees were there in 1947? There were 700,000 refugees, not 5.5 million, and this is something which I think Ilan, I'm afraid, has been quite reluctant to answer. There were 700,000 refugees. There was a civil war that started, the major feature of which was the Palestinian besieging and cutting off of Western Jerusalem, in which, and that was followed ultimately later in 1947 by the expulsion of the Jewish population of the old city of Jerusalem.
Okay, now I just would like you to now to address the question just raised from the floor.
Which is?
Well, do you want to repeat your question?
Well, when I spoke to the mayor of Jerusalem and asked him about the recent 5,000 homes that he just announced, and he laughed and said, actually, it's 90,000. We just haven't announced that full figure yet.
Can I tell you this?
And that was just last year, mate.
Can I tell you this, that if you're asking me, my view is that what's needed to be done is to progress straight away with the two-state solution. The establishment of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, as far as I'm concerned, is an absolute priority. It's a priority for the Palestinians and it's a priority for Israelis. The occupation, and there has been partial evacuation, partial withdrawal by the Israelis of the West Bank, total withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, but in my view, what is needed is an end to all this occupation. We need a peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We need a Palestinian state alongside Israel. There's no substitute for it, and that needs to be done now, full stop.
Okay, I'm just going to quickly go around the panel because we've run out of time. Greg Sheridan, first of all, just some summary comments.
Well, you know, what a wonderful range of subjects we've traversed, but I certainly believe, as a foreign editor, that Israel is as civilised and decent a country as any country that I visit, and under terrible provocation, it tries very hard to behave morally. It doesn't always succeed. It has a range of independent institutions which hold things accountable. And I think the bizarre focus on the undoubted injustices within Israel of the world, to the exclusion of the terrible human rights abuses all over the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, is a bit weird.
Ilan.
Yes, I think the rest of the world would be able to treat much better the abuses of human rights and other atrocities that occur in the Middle East if it will see a transparent Western position towards the atrocities that Israel committed in the past and commits in the present. And in fact, only a genuine democracy in which every Jew, Muslim and Christian would have equal rights and democratic rights is the basis for a future solution. Israel today does not grant these rights. Israel in the future will not grant this right. What we need is a different political outfit which would respect the human rights and the civil rights of everyone who lives between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean and everyone who was expelled from that country.
Robin.
I can't better that.
Sorry?
I can't better that.
Furthermore.
Well, as I said before, I think we should be looking for a solution, and I think we should be looking for reconciliation, and I think a democracy where everyone is treated equally is clearly what we should be looking for.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for tonight. Please thank our panel, Greg Sheridan, Ilan Pappe, Clover Moore, Robin Davidson and Irving Wallach.
You have been listening to a portion of a forum which took place in Australia on a television program called Q&A, featuring historian Ilan Pappe, who wrote The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, defending the Palestinian narrative against the Zionist narrative articulated by Irving Wallach and Greg Sheridan. The second clash of narratives we present this morning features Daniel Pollack of the Zionist Organization of America challenging professor and author Norman Finkelstein, who argues the Palestinian narrative. This portion of the broadcast is excerpted from a program on the RT television network and downloaded from YouTube.
Well, the implications of this annual conference are enormous every year. But this one in particular, with the Arab Spring, and also recent new partnerships in the Middle East, and an overall changing mood. There is so much that can be said about all of this, of course, and certainly there are some strong opinions on all sides, Well, to give us a few of those opinions, I'm joined here in studio by Dan Pollack, co-director of government relations for the Zionist Organization of America. And in our New York studio, Norman Finkelstein, political scientist and also author of This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. And, you know, as we start this discussion, I think it's going to be important to clarify a few different things. Now, when it comes to Middle East peace, and Dan, I will start with you, what is acceptable? What, I mean, are you willing to negotiate, and what would you be willing to give up or give in on?
Well, to begin with, I work for an American organization, not the Israeli government. But the Israelis are extremely anxious to have peace. At this AIPAC conference, about all they talk about is peace and how it should be achieved. So peace is the ultimate objective of everyone I know in Israel on both sides of the political spectrum. The problem is about what the conflict is really about. And the United States, in formulating issues relating to territory, is not getting to the core issue. The core issue, in my view, and probably in the view of most Israelis, is the inability of the Arab world and the Palestinians to accept the very existence of a Jewish state in the midst of the Middle East. And until that issue gets satisfied, all the talk of potential border resolutions and all the other things that are being focused on really don't get us towards that end of peace.
And I think President Obama even mentioned that in his speech at AIPAC yesterday, that it is absolutely, you know, essential that people from Israel are negotiating with others who recognize them. However, on the other side of that, people in Palestine think the same thing. They want to be recognized as their own state, and they don't feel like they are. So, Norman, I'll have you speak to that, you know, the recognition of what each side is.
The basic principles for resolving the conflict have been put forth repeatedly by the international community, whether it be the International Court of Justice in July 2004 or the United Nations General Assembly in annual resolution. The terms are straightforward. There has to be a two-state settlement on the June 1967 border, Israel exercising sovereignty and independence within its state, and the Palestinians exercising sovereignty and self-determination in the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem as its capital. And there also has to be a just resolution of the Palestinian refugee question. Those are the terms. Now, Ken has added a new term. He says that Israel has to be recognized as a Jewish state. But there's no basis of that for that in international law. And in fact, your listeners have to remember, this is not the first time Israel has attempted to settle its conflict with its neighbors. They have a peace treaty with Egypt. It was signed in 1979. They have a peace treaty with Jordan. It was signed in 1994. In neither case, if you read the texts of these peace treaties, in neither case is there any mention of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Mr. Pollack is simply pulling this rabbit out of the hat, another means to sabotage a resolution of the conflict on the basis of the law.
I'll let you respond to that, Dan.
I really couldn't disagree more with several points. First of all, the international law that applies here is UN Resolution 242, which does not require that all of the disputed territory of what Israelis called Judea and Samaria, and what Dr. Finkelstein called the West Bank, be given to the Palestinians. In fact, it's disputed territory. The Palestinian negotiating ploy seems to be, what's yours is negotiable and what's mine is mine. As he said, in its entirety, everything has to be part of the Palestinian state. In fact, that is precisely what needs to be negotiated. And it is the Arab side who has steadfastly refused to enter into negotiations, direct negotiations, that could lead to any kind of peaceful resolution. So he's wrong about the international law that applies. The General Assembly does not determine international law. So the fact that they say that Jerusalem should be the capital of the Palestinian state...
But don't you think, Dan, when you say that the Palestinians have said that they're not willing to give anything, I mean, we saw with the Palestinian papers, we saw with a lot of different things that have happened and have come out in the last few months, that in fact, at least the Palestinian leaders have been willing to put just about everything on the table when it comes to negotiating, and there's just a few things that they've asked for from Israel that don't seem to be, no one seems to be budging on.
Well, actually, those papers were transcripts of the Palestinian side of negotiations from several years ago. And there's two important facts to know about that. First of all, they haven't put anything on the table. They haven't agreed to even sit down with the Israelis and discuss things through the vast majority of the Obama term. But secondly, the reason those Palestinian papers made such news is that the Palestinian negotiators have been withholding these very negotiating positions from their own people. And in fact, they disavowed them and still claim to this day that those very concessions about allowing some Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem to remain under Israeli control, they denied that they ever made such concessions. Now, I would be very pleased if a Palestinian negotiating team would return to the table with Israel and start negotiating on whatever basis, and I would be pleased if they would actually observe the agreements they've made in the past, which require them to stop incitement against the Jewish state. And finally, I would be pleased if they would choose peace instead of the Fatah-Hamas agreement, where they've just made an agreement over the last 2 weeks with Hamas, which is a terrorist state as defined by the European Union and the United States, a terrorist entity, and not helpful neither to American diplomacy in the region nor the prospects of peace.
And we should mention that Hamas and Fatah are meeting in Moscow to talk about this, and it is not, Hamas is not called a terrorist organization by everyone, not by Moscow and not by the United Nations, I believe. But still, Moscow has asked Hamas, and I'll let you get in here in just a second, but let's talk about what's going on here. Moscow has asked Hamas consider recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Does this have to happen? And if it does happen, what would be the result?
Norm. Well, I think there are three things to be said. First of all, as I mentioned a moment ago, there is no precedent in international law, and there's no precedent in the peace treaties Israel has already signed with Egypt or Jordan for recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Number two, everybody talks about what Hamas has to do, but what about what Israel has to do? The very same day, last Friday, when President Obama delivered his speech on the Middle East, the New York Times ran a large op-ed by the deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset, who also happens to be a senior member of the Likud party, Mr. Netanyahu's party. Now, bear in mind, the Likud is the most moderate element of Netanyahu's coalition. So we're not talking about extremists like Avigdor Lieberman. We're talking about the moderate Likud. And in the op-ed, Danny Dannon, the senior member of Likud, he put forward his vision, the deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset, his vision for resolving the conflict. He said Israel should annex all of the Jewish communities, as he calls them, the illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, all of what he calls the uninhabited areas of the West Bank, and he says, we will let the Palestinians in the main towns of the West Bank have independence, which means Israel will annex 97% of the West Bank, and the Palestinians in the main towns, that is to say 3% of the West Bank, they can have independence. Now, bear in mind, that's the vision of the most moderate element of Netanyahu's coalition. And yet everybody says or tells Hamas what it must do.
You have been listening to a portion of a debate between Professor Norman Finkelstein, presenting the Palestinian narrative, and Daniel Pollack, representing the Zionist Organization of America and the Zionist narrative, as broadcast on the RT television network. Well, I hope this morning's broadcast has not been too confusing. We've tried to provide examples of how the Zionist narrative, the Zionist talking points, which are often factually disingenuous, are being used to justify the occupation and the colonization of the Palestinian homeland, and how the fact-based Palestinian narrative is being used to counter that false narrative. We urge you to read the history, study the maps, and draw your own conclusions as to which narrative is more truthful. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.